Hi, folks. Welcome to the final lecture, Lecture 10. This is a bonus lecture. So usually in other quarters, other years, we've only had 9 weeks because one of the Mondays is usually a holiday, but because we're online, we were able to sneak in another one. So this will be material that I haven't really covered in past years, but hopefully it's kind of interesting. I'm going to target like 30 minutes for today's lecture, so it won't be a very big one. Hopefully you found this class useful. And if you want to talk about any of the ideas that were mentioned in this class, or if you want to talk about your own research, feel free to reach out. It's been very bizarre for me this quarter not being able to get to know you folks better. So definitely feel free to reach out. Okay, let's talk about Mendelian randomization, which is a very popular way inside of epidemiology to implement instrumental variables. And talk about that. So Mendelian randomizations make use of, what is it, meiosis? Is that it? When cells divide, they separate up their genetic information, and you can end up with something that looks like a pretty random process, where certain kinds of genetic traits are getting passed along. And then when the sex chromosomes combine from the parents, you can get like sort of new traits emerging. But that process there, looks pretty random. And it's not formally random in the sort of completely independent sense, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But like smack dab in the middle of rather complicated processes are something that looks like a fairly well understood random process that we might be able to leverage. And the idea is, in epidemiological studies, we'll be interested in things like, does alcohol consumption link to cancer? And then the concern is that, well, maybe people are using, I guess this one doesn't have a reverse causality I was looking for, but maybe like people are who are predisposed to alcohol consumption are also predisposed to get cancer. And there are other cases where it's something like people who are schizophrenic or something like that might be less likely to eat certain foods, once they really get into schizophrenia, might start lowering or modifying their dietary directions, their dietary habits, such that they start to reduce their folate consumption. So like the issue is that a lot of times you can see these really strong correlations, but it's not clear what the causal direction is or if there's other unobserved confounders. Like, so I really want to emphasize at the moment that especially the reverse causation, where it's people are not 100% sure if this causes that or that causes this, A causes B or B causes A. And that's where Mendelian randomization really got like a lot of traction, is that if we look at genes, and you have to like spot me a little bit of this logic here for a minute, but say I have a gene and it predisposes me to either like or not like alcohol, like just sort of, it's not my tastes or something like that. If we can really know that that gene does modify that exposure, that behavior, then that was kind of like assigned to me at birth, and therefore I'm less likely to have to consume alcohol. And by the way, I mean, obviously that can get overridden, right? If I'm in a certain cultural context, I'll drink more, and if I'm in a different cultural context, I'll drink less. But there's some baseline encouragement, some kind of instrument that is modifying or predisposing me to either up my dosing or lowering my dosing. That's the idea. And the important thing here, again, is that this is kind of useful for unpacking that direction of causality, because it was assigned to me at the very beginning of my life. That's what Mendelian randomization is nice for. Excuse me. I forgot to mention on slide 3, we have a couple nice reviews. These are from like the mid 2000s. And so feel free to dig into those. A lot of the lectures today is built off of this. And here's some examples on slide 4. of and actually inside of Lawler, the citation there at the bottom of slide four, there's a bunch of nice citations of different connections between gene to trait and trait to outcome. And so what I've got here in the examples are traits that people are interested in, and then the outcome that they potentially are associated with. And then hidden behind that is like there's some gene that they believe modifies C-reactive protein, or some gene that modifies people's alcohol consumption. So let's take a look at slide five. This is what's going on. So in a Mendelian randomization, there's lots of other things going on, but that example that I was seeking out first is, explaining first is like, we've got some exposure, some treatment, some kind of like dosing for alcohol, and we want to know its connection to cancer rates. But we're worried about like maybe there's something like risk-seeking behavior that might confound this, that might have that might bias our estimate. And so the hope is that we can use genes as an instrument, which again doesn't totally set alcohol levels, but it does sort of encourage you to either be more likely to have alcohol or less likely to have alcohol. And then as an instrument, right, we have a couple assumptions. One is that the gene really does have that connection, that it only has that connection. You know, it doesn't go from Z directly to Y and doesn't go from Z to the unobserved variables that we're worried about. So there's not a short circuiting of the gene directly to the outcome. Like if this gene really did modify use of alcohol, but it also directly modified cancer rate, not passing through anything else, just modified that, that would be very bad. That would not be an instrument. And so everything that's going on inside of the Mendelian randomization study can be thought of as an instrument. It is just a form of an instrument. And I'll unpack that a little bit more in just a minute with like some of the sort of common concerns or the common critiques of a Mendelian randomization study. So again, slide six, the big like benefit of a Mendelian randomization is there are sort of two. One is the temporal ordering. We think that because the genes are assigned at birth and then all behaviors emerge after that, that we have some directionality of the causation, that the behaviors are less likely impacted by that presence of the outcome. I'm not sure that actually holds, right? To me, behaviors like dominate a huge chunk, and like are socially constructed, are not purely genes. I'm much more of a nurture versus a nature kind of person. But it does make sense that if you look at population level, if you have the gene that predisposes you to not like cilantro, then you're just gonna eat less cilantro. If you really like cilantro, it's less likely that you're gonna have that sort of like soapy tasting gene, that kind of stuff. The other thing is, again, what I was trying to describe, I was not doing a great job because I'm not a geneticist, but that we believe that we have some relatively strong theory that says that genes behave kind of randomly. So those are the two things that really make people excited about Mendelian randomizations when you're doing an epidemiological study. So it's really good to deploy them as part of like an overall portfolio of research if you're really trying to get a an exposure or treatment or an intervention in the outcome. That exposure, you should investigate like 4, 5, 6 different kinds of studies, and then a Mendelian randomization can really kind of like lock down like a temporal order, or it can really do a good job of beating back concerns about temporal ordering. But I do want to caution you that usually a Mendelian randomization, because of the issues I'll start bringing up on the next three slides, people have started to shy away from them, especially in epidemiology, and like economists were using them for a little while and they really started to shy away because of a couple of the concerns. I'm sort of foreshadowing here in this last bullet point on slide six. Part of this is because it really requires you to have a good, solid understanding of how the gene is connected to the trait. So if you don't have a good biological basis for behavior, and you don't really believe that, then you should be kind of skittish of this. And so like, I definitely find myself in that camp. If you are unsure about the biology that gives rise to, you know, so the discussion that I was giving just a minute ago, where it's like, I have a gene, it makes me taste cilantro as kind of like soapy. Or I have a gene and it makes me not like super comfortable when I drink alcohol. Or I have a gene and it changes my LDL. Those have different base, low density lipoproteins. So those have different sort of biological bases. I would say the mechanism for understanding my cilantro is fairly clear. Whereas the LDL is like, is also fairly clear. And then like alcohol to me is like a little bit weirder, where I don't know the exact biological mechanism that would totally determine all of my alcohol behaviors. So the connections can be more or less wobbly, I guess is what I'm trying to say. The other thing that I think made people a little bit worried about, this is probably a better way to say what I'm getting at here with this last bullet point on slide six, make people a little bit concerned with Mendelian randomization is because, especially in the 2000s, as people have started to like ramp up on these kinds of studies, we have not been super solid in like this gene here changes that behavior, or this gene here changes the way my body sheds folate, or this, you know, right? So people have a fairly strong belief early on, once like a new paper comes out in Science or Cell or something like that. And then people will do Mendelian randomization saying, oh, this gene causes this kind of behavior or is really predisposing people to this. And then maybe like, I don't know, like 5 years later, someone comes out and is like, hey, by the way, that gene trait connection, that gene behavior connection is not nearly as strong as we thought. And so what happens is that instrument is kind of faulty or contingent and really is sort of based on science that's still developing. So that level of science maybe hasn't been there for very long. And so I think Mendelian randomizations will get sort of stronger into the future as people build up stronger relationships and correlational studies and really get into the, you know, repeated correlational studies. So you show that like repetitions of this across different populations, across different data sets, across different kinds of people. But then also like working out like the exact causal structures that give rise to the gene presence or absence and the behavioral presence or absence. What has happened to several Mendelian randomization studies is like the quote unquote science, the genetic science was reversed later on. And so people have been a little bit hesitant to deploy these. Okay, so the main challenges, these are all, by the way, the next three slides, 7, 8, and 9, these are all repackaged or set a different way than the assumptions that we have for instruments. But these are just looking at them differently. These are all violations of the instrumental variable assumptions. They just kind of like, we talk about them differently and we think about them slightly differently. And then we're sort of emphasizing different features of the points of failure inside of Mendelian randomization, but these are fundamentally statistically just the same exact things as the instrumental variable assumptions. So the first one is association with unmeasured confounders through population stratification. So in Mendelian randomization, a lot of times people will not have access to an individual person's parents. And if you had access to their parents, you would be able to say something like, oh, mom donor had these genes and dad donor had these genes, and there was this kind of probability that that child would have this kind of these sets of traits. If you have that, this problem goes away. So if you have the parents and you can condition on the parents, you now understand the instrument quite well because you understand all of the different ways that this child could have gotten the genes. But for population stratification issues, here's the deal. It's like you can sometimes, if you're looking at a population and you haven't really thought very carefully about it, you can get subpopulations which have the co-presence, like sort of higher genetic variants of a gene that co-occur with different kinds of behaviors. Right? So like you can imagine the one that people mention a lot is like there are certain populations that have genes that make them more or less likely to use alcohol. But then also along with that comes, you know, and so this is a subpopulation. There's usually a culture wrapped around that subpopulation, and that culture tends to produce its own dietary habits. And so you can imagine something like, this subpopulation doesn't use alcohol, but it loves, grilling meats. And grilling meats are also linked to high rates of cancer or something like that. Or they use a lot of alcohol in this subgroup. Their genes seem to be very highly linked with this. And then it also turns out that behaviorally, they smoke a lot or something like that. So you have to be careful when you are deploying a Mendelian randomization to be aware that the prevalence of genes and subgroups can also be correlated with other unobserved variables that can cause that are causing the confounding between the exposure and the outcome. Slide 8. This one is goes down to the behavior of the instrument itself. So the genes. So again, and I'm not a geneticist, so take this with a grain of salt. But like at first pass, it kind of feels like, oh, you're like kind of like flipping a coin. Mom's got these two alleles, dad's got these two alleles, and therefore we've got this 2x2 table for the kinds of distributions that I would get. But it turns out that that's actually not totally correct, because there are dependent structures between genes. So, again, I feel a little nervous when I explain this up, but like, you got like a long string of DNA, right? And there are chunks of these that we refer to as genes. And these genes can have, you know, like if I'm on this one section, and that's the gene we're talking about, whether it's present or not, or I've got this variant versus that variant, well, right next to that, in this long string of DNA, maybe another snippet of gene that like turns on and off. And the issue is that if I get one genetic variant, it might co-occur with another gene that is physically quite close to it on the DNA. And so you don't get fully independent genes where every gene is being randomly flipped. They actually co-occur. There's some joint distribution. That's what you have to worry about. So like I say here on slide 8, if you're looking at gene A as your instrument, it could quite possibly be that gene B, which is physically on the DNA quite close to it, will also co-occur at roughly the same rates. And if gene B has a connection to the outcome that doesn't completely pass through your exposure, through your treatment, through the pathway you're interested in, if it goes some other route to the outcome, then that's a problem. That's that, you know, if you're looking back at that picture up above slide 5, it would be like Z is on the lower, that like lower line that I draw back there on slide 5. There would be your gene to another gene, which then goes back through like you, that angle down there. So we'll get better and better at dealing with genetic linkage issues as we build up more and more in the science of genes and understanding those things. So you can't just like walk into a Mendelian randomization and feel like you know this based on like one study, or the behavior of the instrument based on that one study. You really have to dig into the possible genetic structures and the way that like these traits arise. The other thing is pleiotropy. And I'm sure I'm saying that wrong, but the idea is that it's not clear that, again, this is like a level of science thing, maybe we'll get better at this in the future, but when we say a gene causes a difference in a particular thing, like the example I use here is low density lipoproteins, like the cholesterol, you might have a gene that increases LDL, and you want to know, like, does LDL cause heart attacks? Well, you know, the issue is that, like, the gene we might know the most about increases LDL, but it also increases HDL, the high-density lipoprotein, which most people think is good. So now it becomes, like, a more complicated pathway thing, right? Like, where the instrument itself causes a change in the exposure we're interested in, but it now introduces a second pathway, in this case, HDL, that then may like cause a change in the outcome. We believe has a cause changes are causing the outcome. So like genes are very rarely only impacting one thing. They're probably giving rise to several different either behaviors or conditions. And so pleiotropy is usually the one that people are oftentimes quite worried about. And again, you might get some really more sophisticated level of genetics in the future, but right now, this is probably the one that like most people attack Mendelian randomizations using. Cool. So the takeaways. Mendelian randomizations are instrumental variables, and they have some really nice features to them. And the biggest one is like if you're worried about reverse causality, if you are worried that we don't know if A is causing B or if B is causing A because we can't like sort of figure out this like temporal ordering, or maybe like A kicks off B, but then B feedbacks into A, and then A feedback into B, and like this all the very... So a Mendelian randomization, because in some sense, the initial starting condition is a predisposition to have that behavior, have that trait, or not have that trait, not have that behavior, then it gives you some sense of like what that initial nudge is doing and its impact on the outcome. So again, I hope I made it very clear that you can't just say, oh, I found this one paper where someone said this gene is linked to this kind of trait or behavior, and then go running off, because there's a lot of other issues hidden behind there that you, when you think carefully about how an instrument works and the assumptions, you really have to understand the genetics. And I can't stress this enough, and I don't think it gets appreciated, but like if you can go and get genetic information on parents, like essentially do like a sibling study, if you can get the genetic information on parents and then the genetic information on the siblings, now you've got a very strong setup. So for the Mendelian randomization, you can do away with a couple of the other kinds of issues that you're worried about. It doesn't get to the pleiotropy, but it does to some degree deal with both 7 and to a lesser degree, the issue on slide 7 and the issue to a lesser degree on slide 8. Cool. So, you know, transitioning on slide 11. I think synthetic controls are both super interesting and completely weird to me. And a big chunk of that is because they are kind of causally. And they also occupy this weird sort of world where it looks to me like something that probably should be done by very deep, rigorous, qualitative thinking. But it's sort of like maybe some quants are trying to add in an interesting way of viewing things. But I do want to caution you that synthetic controls just like strike me as being a bit odd, and I think should be viewed rather cautiously. But they've become quite popular. And I'll give you an example. You know, and they get used a lot, and I think they do add something valuable to the conversation. But I think they are weird, okay? I'm going to try to make sure that that comes across. So slide 12. So here's an example. And this is a paper that just came out not too long ago in Prevention Science, and I've got a link there at the bottom of slide 12. There was a major firearm shooting in 1996 in Australia. And after that, there were some real policy changes. I think they instituted like a major buyback of both sort of like quote-unquote like long guns and, you know, handguns. And then I think maybe there's maybe two other major events, like sort of early 2000s, then another major one in 2014. And so they've had some very big responses to shootings. And the question is, like, that was a policy change. We did that because we thought it would cause a change in the rates of firearm deaths. And is that true? It feels like that should be an answerable question. But like I say here in slide 12, that last bullet is like, well, like, what's the unit of observation? In this policy setting, it was a countrywide setting. So everybody inside of Australia was impacted. How do we think about this? And, you know, let me just go to slide 13. There are policy settings that impact large groups of people, and I've given you examples of that before, like the neonatal intensive care, you know, with the premature babies that I've been talking about. The other one is like the dissection example. These are both like regionalization, where for a region, we would go from one policy to another, and everybody inside of that area would be impacted. And so people deploy, they don't really deploy synthetic controls for something like regionalization, because you can get individuals inside of this like in who are receiving care who seem to be acting as if they were on that new policy, and other people who were acting as if they weren't. So that's really the kind of like way that I usually investigate policy settings, is to get down to the individual level and build up or like sort of section off, find some of the people who are acting as if they had this policy, other people who act as if they had the other policy, and try to find some reasonable ways that they got sorted into that, right? That's what the instruments and stuff are about. So that's weird, what I just did there, because like there's... like in my setup, there is a policy change, which is we would go from having, you know, sort of random care or, you know, wherever you sort yourself kind of care to being regionalized. So that's a fairly large level of aggregation. We either do this or not in this region. So what's different between that and like this policy setting? Well, there's a couple different things. One is, and again, I'm on slide 13. So the firearm policy, I think a lot of people think that in the case of like firearm policies or some of the other places where people are deploying synthetic controls, that there's a lot of interference, that we can't necessarily disentangle some of the social elements or actions that people would take purely based on their individual behaviors, because there's a lot of emergent properties as people interact under this new policy versus not. So I think people worry correctly in a lot of policy settings about SUDVA violations, interference. The other major issue, like the difference between like the kinds of examples that I've been giving you with like neonatal intensive care units and dissection versus like something like this handgun example, or the the firearm example, is that we had individual data and they didn't. So I think that's actually what motivates some of the deployment of the synthetic controls. But I think a more principled basis is that people think of the unit of observation as being much larger, and that there's too much sustained interference to really do a good job of, even if you were to have individual level data analyses on that. So on slide 14, to get you a little bit deeper into what's going on with synthetic controls, you know, before, you know, again, you have a major policy, it impacts a large unit of observation, a unit of aggregation. So like an entire city changes its policies, or a state or a country or something like that. Prior to 2000s, so like, I think like really I think it only got really super formalized in maybe like 2010 or something like that. Synthetic controls, but people were using like sort of the math of it back in 2003, and I think it really got its naming in sort of like the mid-aughts. But even prior to that, people would still investigate these questions, and what they would do, not using synthetic controls, but say like, okay, I've got this new policy in this one region. What I'm going to do is find a bunch of other regions that had variation in the policies that they would use. I will describe the heck out of their pre-policy, but prior to the change, I will say exactly what was going on there. I'll talk about the political considerations of what they were doing. In this case, like they had no firearm bans all the way to like completely banning them, and all the different policies. I'll just describe the heck out of that. People would then also do, well, what did it look like as people were implementing this policy change? What were the politics of that? What were the mechanics of it? What were the logistics? Like in Australia, they did a lot of buybacks. And so what were the compensation rates? Did people show up? What was that like? How contentious was it? Who were the parties that were sort of pro or con? What were the arguments that they were using? And then they would spend time in this qualitative deep dive talking about in the post period what happened in the country that implemented this new policy, but also then talking about, well, what happened in these other regions that we're comparing them to who didn't really have a change in their policy. And I really want to emphasize, this is good research, right? It's not quantitative. It's not, out of this, you're not going to get a deep measurement out of it, but you are going to get a deep understanding of all the various flows of choices, of considerations. You'll get the sense of the variation and how people were tackling the problem. So this is excellent causal research. It's just not the kind of stuff that we're doing in statistics. And this can be paired and should be paired with a synthetic cohort kind of design, synthetic control kind of design. But what am I saying here is, like, this would, a study like described on slide 14 would mostly appear in words, and there would be very few numbers except for summary statistics, right? And that's how people before 2000s would have done this kind of, like, oh, Australia enacted this policy. What would the downstream consequences of that? And so on slide 15, you know, people wanted to augment. People wanted to get some more numerical understanding of what's going on there. So, like, they tried to come up with a more quantitative approach for this. And here's the idea, is fundamentally in this approach, you're thinking that there's one unit of observation, in our case, like the motivating example here, Australia. And Australia made a policy change, and you're going to try to find some counterfactual to compare to. And the issue is, especially when you get to something like a country where there's not a lot of other countries out there, like what serves as a good counterfactual? Is it like New Zealand? Is it the United States? Well, I mean, there's a whole bunch of reasons that you should answer no, that New Zealand is not a good stand-in, that no, that like the United States is clearly not a good stand-in. But maybe what you can do, and this is what the synthetic controls try to give you, is maybe we can take like a weighted average. Maybe we can mix together several other countries who didn't have the policy change. And on average, through this weighted average, we might be able to get a good sense of what they might have been like, what Australia might have been like if they hadn't enacted that policy. So that's what's going on here. So if you go into slide 16, in this paper, they had, I think it's actually like maybe 20-ish countries that they were considering. And in table one, what they're doing is they're telling you on the left-hand side that when they were considering homicides and, you know, the rates of homicides through time and seeing what would happen, you know, with gun-related deaths, what they ended up doing was they said, okay, in order to understand what could have happened for Australia, we'll build synthetic Australia. And synthetic Australia is 30% Norway, 20% the United States, you know, 18% Singapore, 14% New Zealand, and so on and so forth. So that was, and then they also have a couple other ones, which I'll show you in a couple other slides, but they also considered a different outcome, which was motor vehicle deaths and then suicides. So what they're doing there is they're looking at the historical outcomes inside of Norway, United Kingdom, Singapore, and they're trying to build up a weighted average that through time of those countries looks very similar to Australia's through time. So you can see this, just turn your eyes just a little bit to figure one. And you see that the strong line there, the dark line, that's Australia through time. So from the 1968 or whatever up until 1996, you see what their homicide rates were through time. And then the dotted line, that's the synthetic Australia. That's the one with the 0.3 Norway, 0.2 UK, 0.18 Singapore. And you see that that line kind of follows pretty closely up until 1996. And again, 1996 is roughly when Australia started its new policy. And I haven't told you how they got these weights, right? But you can see that they seem to have accomplished what they set out to, which is if they use those weights for Norway, UK, Singapore, to create a synthetic Australia, that weighting does follow, track really closely up until 1996, where there was a policy departure. And now you see that Australia just plummets. The rate of age-adjusted homicides drops off a cliff, whereas everybody else relatively stays the same. And you know, there's several things going on here, and I'm going to unpack this, but you can see, like, you can see what they were getting at, and you can see what they seem to have accomplished, and that divergence on the Y, it seems to hint to you that if Australia had not implemented its policy change in 1996, 1997, then you would have seen it its rates of homicide stay more flat where that dotted line is on the right hand side of figure one. Well, okay, like, there's a bunch of natural questions once you see a plot like that that you probably want to start pushing on, which is like, wait a second, shouldn't we have like some sort of confidence intervals or confidence bands? around that. Like, yes, I see a big departure on the right-hand side of figure one, but, like, shouldn't, like, is that, like, meaningful? And fundamentally, we have no idea. Nobody's really come up with a great way of talking about measures of uncertainty for synthetic controls. First off, it's not clear, are you doing some sort of sampling approach? Are you doing some sort of permutational, like what they randomly assigned? But also there, it's like you really only have two in some fractional numbers of observations, right? You have Australia, and then you have this like synthetic control, which is kind of like one-ish Australia. And maybe the uncertainty should be around the construction of that synthetic Australia. Like maybe we could do some like kind of like bootstrapping or something like that. But nobody's really settled on a good way to get uncertainty intervals here. They, right off the bat, the folks who created synthetic controls are very clear. I mean, they're not confused at all about, like, you know, the limitations and what they're able to achieve and that kind of stuff. So it's really good to go back and read, like, Abate and, oh man, I'm blanking on people's names, and it's embarrassing because one of the guys is here at Stanford. Well, I'll put the link here. And so what they did is they proposed two kind of, like, checks. And both of these are versions of known null checks. To see if, like, things are maybe going wrong. So while we can't get, like, uncertainty bounds, what we can do is replicate the study's procedures and see if things have gone awry, if, like, the procedure is giving you corrupted answers that you know don't map onto reality. So the first one that they offer is, like, a time check. And so that is, in our case, like, there was a major policy change in Australia in 1996, 1997, but there shouldn't have been one back in the 70s, right? Because no policy was enacted. So what you could do is you could build up the same sort of like setup using the same sort of procedures, same sort of weighting schemes, and then see if there was a divergence, you know, post 1980 or something like that, right? So there shouldn't be, because nobody enacted any, you know, in Australia enacted any policy changes. And if there is a change, now you start getting very concerned. The other check, and so that, by the way, these checks are only one direction, right? They're sort of like the canary in the coal mine. If something like looks weird from them, you shouldn't proceed. It's nice to not see anything, but there's no guarantees that if they don't produce weird results, either of these checks don't produce weird results, then you are okay. There's no guarantee like that. It's a one-sided, like, if these fail, you're in a bad situation, but if they're okay, I don't know. So the other one they have is a control check. So the idea here is, while we were thinking Australia should show this divergence, maybe the procedure, the way we're setting this up, is just bound to always show us a divergence. So what we could do is we could pull Australia out, and then we could start with the, I don't know, 20-ish countries that we were considering, and we could take one country at a time, randomly pick, or, you know, sort of take one at a time, and then use this procedure and see, oh, does the United States diverge? Does the UK diverge? Does New Zealand? And each time you're building up a new synthetic group. So that's what the idea is here. So that would give you some distribution of the divergence that this procedure produces, and then you feel good if you see that Australia really has the biggest divergence, because that's what you'd anticipate. All the other ones are in some sense like some sort of like random noise from the procedures mechanism. So again, that's not really a test. It's not really, you know, it doesn't have all the properties that we would normally like, but it does sort of like match intuitions. So what they did for this paper that I've been using on the firearms, so I'm now on slide 18, for the firearm policy in Australia, is they did a couple other different checks, which are kind of which are definitely interesting, worth talking about. So on slide 18, they looked at motor vehicles. So here, this is a different kind of known null check, where if you change firearm policies, you probably shouldn't really be seeing much of a difference in terms of fatalities due to motor vehicles. So I think like this is interesting that these two curves here on figure two don't diverge, whereas before they looked like they diverged. And I want to pause here. So I'm going to tilt my hand here a little bit, but I was a reviewer on this paper, and that's why I was sort of like, particularly interested in this. But if you look at the y-axis on figure 2, and then you scroll up to the y-axis on figure 16, I really don't like synthetic control grooves. In part because, like, that measurement of uncertainty, right? Like, the divergence here on slide 16, when you're looking at figure 1 on slide 16, it looks really big. But if you look at the y-axis, I'm just not sure how uncertain, you know, if that gap that we're seeing is really sort of meaningful and stable, and I should, like, believe it. Because if you now look at, like, slide 18, well, that gap in figure 2 on slide 18 doesn't look that big. If you look at that y-axis, that's much bigger. But, you know, it's all relative, right? And that's why we need standard errors, is because I can't eyeball this. I don't know how uncertain those lines are. But this is a nice check. It does help them that there doesn't seem to be, you know, a huge change in the overall shape and trajectories of these curves in figure 2. Again, I'm not saying this is great, right? This is not like, you know, woohoo, they nailed this. But motor vehicles doesn't seem to have a change in the shape of the curves the way that the figure 1 did. Figure 3, what they're doing there is checking for coherence. So while there was a change in 96, there was also another major change in, like, 2004, I think. There was another shooting. Maybe I have the times wrong, because it looks like they have, like, another buyback in 2003 from slide 3. So they're just trying to say, are things looking following our theories? And that's a nice set of checks. Okay, so last couple slides. The slide 19 is the math of this. It's not a terribly hard conceptually. There are many different ways that people are getting fancy in doing this, but the general gist is you divide time up into the pre-period, which is usually like T0, and then the post-period, T1. So these are kind of like time series-ish data, right? So there might be like 30 years in the T0 and maybe 4 years in the T1 kind of thing. Altogether, you have, T0 plus T1, so you have T amounts of, like, time. And you're looking at and you have outcomes, quote-unquote, like, outcomes for all of your comparators and the country of interest, the unit of interest. And what you're going to do is, in the second bullet point on slide 19, is to build up a synthetic control group, like a weighted scheme where the Y1 up to YJ, that's the outcome. So in our case, like, it would be like maybe the UK's number of homicide deaths in 1970. That would be the first one. And the next one might be Singapore's homicide deaths in 1970. And then you go all through J countries. And then the W's are their weight, country-specific weight. And that gives you the synthetic outcome for that time T. And you'll do this for every single T. So in our example, 1970, 1971, 1972, dot, 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 all the way up to 1996 for the example that we were looking at. And here's the part where people, like, kind of fiddle around and get kind of fancy, is how do you get those weights? Well, a lot of people use squared loss. And so that's what we've got here in that sigma is saying, look at the actual value in time T for Australia, subtract the synthetic, and the synthetic has a bunch of different weights, right, at time T. Those weights are going to stay stable through time, usually. And we're going to try to pick weights such that when we square the residuals, so square the differences, and sum over all of the pre-period times, that's minimized. So it's some sort of like squared error loss kind of thing going on there. And usually people will subject the constraints such that like the weights sum up to 1. Otherwise there's some weirdness that can go on. But that's the game plan. And, you know, so again, where people fiddle around is instead of using squared loss, you can use other fancier, more adaptive kinds of like setups there. Okay, cool. just doing like a little visualization. You get what I'm saying there, hopefully. It's like, you know, you're not any one of those comparator groups is going to be silly and not like good. And you can, but maybe like on average, when you look through a weighted version of all of those, maybe that like that will give you some more appropriate sense of what's going on. Cool. Last two slides. Slide 22. These are issues that I feel like people don't talk about enough for my tastes, which is that like in a synthetic control, I get sort of worried about this, like, don't things and people and units of observation, but also variables interact? Like, that super concerns me. So the example that I use is, like, imagine I have two chemicals, A and B, and I want to know what happens if I mix them together and then heat them up. Well, like, that can be, like, really unstable, right? And so the fact is, like, those molecules are bumping into each other and they're starting to go through, like, chemical reactions and that kind of stuff. And then if I apply heat, like, wow, like, there's a whole bunch of things that could be happening. And synthetic controls kind of concern me because, like, well, what we're essentially saying is, like, well, heat up chemical A all by itself, then heat up chemical B all by itself, and then kind of, like, weight them 50-50 or something like that to figure out what would happen if we mix them together and applied heat. And obviously I'm being, like, a little aggressive with my analogy here. But, you know, you can sort of see where this would, like, happen. Like, so let's say, like, we're interested in Oakland or something like that. And Oakland has a very diverse population. I don't know the exact proportions, but let's say it's, like, 30% black, 20% Asian, 50% white. And I don't know if that's right. But that would be very, very silly to take a city that's 100% white and average that in with a city that's 100% black and another city that's 100% Asian, and then put them together and say, what would happen if there were a Black Lives Matters, demonstration? Like, it doesn't make sense to me that when people are using synthetic controls, you can have dynamics that emerge when different aspects are either discrete jump points. Like, you can imagine, like, housing policy stuff, really, like, I worry about this a lot, where it's like, we know that there are neighborhood effects, like, as people become, like, feel like they're less and less welcome in a neighborhood, there's, like, some, like, threshold point where they start to jump out. And that doesn't really happen if you start mixing different weighted groups from different areas to get that sense. So what's really happening here, my real critique, so you can sort of see the statistics of it, is I think they are using the wrong level of observation. I think there's some real stuff going on with synthetic controls where they really should be thinking about what's happening on individual person level. And they should get crisp definitions on that level, but instead they're trying to do it on the overall aggregate level, and that doesn't, like, that will give them the wrong sense of some of the emergent properties of a policy change. You should look at people. People matter way more. The second bullet point here that totally gets, like, underappreciated, and I have such a hard time, like, getting people to pay attention to this. So I've linked to a wonderful paper here by Miguel Hernan and also David Rakoff. So the consistency assumption, which is part of SUTVA, and I've mentioned it before, but I am 100% sure I did not do a reasonable job making sure you guys are aware of the consistency assumption, because in many situations, it doesn't matter. It's almost like, let me just say what it is first. It's like, what it says is the outcome for person J is equal to whatever exposure they actually received and how they got set at that level of exposure. So, and that is, if consistency holds, this assumption holds, then it says ignore how they got to that exposure level. All that matters is that they got that exposure level. So K in this setup is, like, did you end up taking the treatment because we randomized you to it? Or is it because we paid you money? Or is it because you didn't have insurance? Or is it because, you know, you got locked up in jail? Like, what is it that got you to this level of the exposure? And a lot of times, you know, it's not a big deal. We can ignore how someone got set to a treatment. I mean, or sorry, maybe a better way to say what I'm saying is, like, usually this issue is taken care of when you thought carefully about the exposure and unexposed and how people got there. Usually it's sort of dealt with that way. But when this gets really, really tricky is when there's a bunch of different treatments, maybe there's only one treatment, but several different control levels, right? So I could either get this surgery or I could get this and then I'm going to contrast that surgery, which is my treatment or my exposure, with medical management. So maybe I'm going to get some pills, or maybe I'm going to get physical therapy, or maybe I'm going to get a different kind of surgery, or maybe, right? So if you have just one treatment and one control, and things are sort of quote unquote normal, this goes away. But the issue, especially when with synthetic controls, is that usually the what happens in a study like this is people will explain the heck out of like Australia and what their policies were. And then they will go and they'll reach out and they'll grab like 20 other countries, and they won't do jack at all, like explaining what the other countries were doing in terms of their policies. And so if you go to like slide 23, I would love to see something like this. So in slide 23, what I've got there is the same, they're looking at homicides, they're looking at the weights, those are the same exact weights as above. But now we've got another column which talks about what policies were enacted during these periods. And maybe I should have like pre-policy and post-policy change in Australia, just so you can get a sense of what these different countries were doing. So you can get a sense of like what the quote-unquote control level is. So my sense is, over and over again, in synthetic controls, when you're not doing, when you're doing sort of a sloppy job with synthetic controls, is you don't have a good sense of what's going on in the counterfactual. We usually explain the heck out of Australia, and then it's actually, you know, 40 different things going on if you think about what's going on in Norway and the UK and Singapore and that kind of stuff. So it would be nice, it is not standard practice, but it would be nice if people started putting together something like slide 23, this table on slide 23, to understand what the control, quote-unquote contrast or controls is doing. Great. So I went way over in the time. I was hoping to keep this like 30 minutes, but I talk. So I've really enjoyed going through this stuff, and I've gotten a series of emails from folks and talked back and forth, so that's been great. But this is a very weird quarter. I mean, we've had a pandemic, we've also had major civil like discourses and change and that kind of stuff. So I just want to say congratulations to making it all the way to the end. Go out to the real world, do good, make people's lives better. And if you want to talk about your own research and you want some advice, or you know, someone to just like do some sanity checks, feel free to reach out. And all my very best to you guys. Thanks.